We have Patrick Dolan. He's from Conti and Dolan Law. He's an employment lawyer. His better half is Karen Conti, not in marriage. Your wonderful wife is great. But Karen Conti is your partner in law, and she has amazing biceps. Mike Leonard is a federal defense attorney, also handles whistleblower cases. Often we talk to them separately, but many times we bring them together because it's more fun to have us all together, the whole gang. We have fun on this program, but we definitely tackle important things, Patrick. You and I have talked about so many issues facing the American workers,
right?
And this, you know, ever-changing laws and how people are treated by their bosses. What are some trending things that you're noticing now?
Well, let's just clear up the non-compete issue again, because I still had somebody call me yesterday and say, oh, I've heard that non-competes are unenforceable. That's just not true. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the FTC rule banning non-competes is not in effect, just to be really clear. And nationwide, it's not in effect, not just here. It's not in effect anywhere. And, you know, that issue has to be litigated if it's ever going to change. And it's, you know, they have not appealed. FTC has not appealed the decision yet, which struck down the non-compete ban. It is anticipated that they will, but they haven't yet. And so that's going to go up to a circuit court of appeals. We'll have another circuit court of appeals with a different opinion. It's going to go to the Supreme Court, but that's months away. So there is no non-compete ban anywhere right now.
Okay. That's the one thing you wanted to make sure you got across. Mike Leonard, we got about a minute before the news. Any big news in your world or cases you've been working on?
Well, we got a lot of trials coming up, and we did score an AI victory.
Ooh.
If you remember on your show.
The college thing.
Yeah. A couple months ago, we discussed on the show this kind of burgeoning thing called AI and how they're using it at universities. So we had a representation of a student from a major Midwestern university accused of using AI for a paper.
Like ChatGPT or something?
That they submitted. We contested the findings of that because he didn't. And we pointed out that there's all these studies and all these major universities saying that the system this school used was not only ineffective, but was essentially had error prone. And the school eventually on appeal agreed with us and reversed it, took the disciplinary action away from the student, and gave them a clean transcript. So
that's
huge. That was a nice win for us.
So that wasn't a court of law, but it was he was represented for this, what was it, appeal process of some kind? Or?
Yeah, as we discussed, a lot of these university systems, when they have disciplinary issues or hearings, could range from anything from sexual misconduct to academic misconduct. We've started to get involved in those cases on the defense side, representing the students and, you know, going through the appeals process for them.
Wow, that's important. Wow, you guys both stuck to the time that I needed you to do so.
We've done this before, John.
We're pros. We're pros, John.
We'll see about the 2 o'clock hour. All right, that's just a taste of what we're going to have. What we really want are your phone calls, 312-981-7200. It's a legal grab bag, and if these guys don't know the answer, they'll sure pretend like they do, and then we promise we'll find an expert to actually try and get the real answer. Patrick Dolan and Mike Leonard are here. Patrick Dolan's an employment lawyer with Conti and Dolan. Patrick, this part's not quite for you, okay?
Okay, I'll sit tight.
You just sit tight.
I'll just listen.
But later on, and we can start getting calls or texts now if you have any employment questions.
Okay.
Patrick will answer
that. I promise I won't interrupt, John.
Yeah, thank you. I don't have to turn off your mic?
Nope. I won't say anything.
Mike Leonard, this seems to be more in your wheelhouse. You're a federal defense attorney. We've talked about bribery cases and the Supreme Court case this past summer in which the Supreme Court basically said that, what, bribery has to come on the front end. It has to be a legit quid pro quo. And that's how bribery can still be found to be bribery. But if it's a gift or something after the fact, and you can't link the two, that can be not bribery. Did I kind of sum that up okay?
Yeah,
before we get to Jim?
Yeah, essentially it was the Snyder case. That was the former official from Indiana. And the argument was, well, he received a gratuity, a benefit after the fact, after he'd taken official action. And the prosecution's theory was that was sufficient to convict him of bribery. That went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. They said no. Essentially a contribution, some benefit after the fact wasn't sufficient under this particular, what's called the 666 federal bribery statute. So that case obviously has implications for the Madigan case. It had implications for the AT&T case that went to trial. It had serious implications for the ComEd case, which was already tried and now will probably have to be retried because of that decision.
And may have implications for Jim. And Jim, I understand that's not your real name, which is totally fine. Welcome to WGN. Thanks for hopping on with us.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
I think we've laid a framework here to begin your discussion. So without getting into too many specifics, as I'm sure you can understand here on WGN, we want you to share your story and then your question in about a minute or two, if you could.
Yeah, certainly. I was charged and pled guilty. I haven't been sentenced, but I was, you know, I've already been through the system. And after that, the Snyder case came down.
What did you plead guilty to?
Conspiracy to commit bribery and a tax, false tax information.
Okay. Do you want to share any of the basic broad strokes of the case or no?
I don't know that that's a good idea. I don't think my attorney would appreciate me even calling you guys. But
okay. And Mike's nodding along here as a federal defense attorney. So that's fine. We can keep it generic. Is your question to dive in deeper to the Snyder case and see if maybe you have a reason to have the case overturned or something? Or what are you asking?
I'm asking what are the consequences now if in fact I haven't committed a crime according to the Supreme Court. What comes of my case? What can I expect?
Interesting. So you've already pled guilty, and now we have the Supreme Court. And you pled guilty, you said this, Jim, but I might have forgotten. You pled guilty before the Snyder decision.
Yes.
And you're awaiting sentencing. All right, Mike, what happens with a case like Jim?
Well, number one, he needs to talk to his attorney about the implications of Snyder on his case. I mean, the big question for Jim would be, are the counts that he pled to, are they even relevant to the Snyder decision? So Snyder involved a public official. And the factual scenario that we briefly described. And so if he hasn't been sentenced yet and the Snyder case, that statute applies to one of the counts that he pled to, then, of course, he'd want to talk to his lawyer about, is there a basis for a motion, perhaps motion withdraw the guilty plea or some other mechanism to address this.
There could be a mechanism here in this interim period between pleading and sentencing that his lawyer could potentially bring up.
Sure, but I'd be surprised, quite frankly, if Snyder applies, because, you know, the lawyer, I'm sure, would have brought that to his attention. And the question is, you know, are the counts that Jim has pled guilty to, are they even relevant to Snyder? So he needs to address those with his attorney and figure out if there's a motion to address that with the court by way of a motion to withdraw the plea or otherwise.
Jim, have you, as your lawyer, reached out since the Snyder case? Have you guys had conversations?
Not as yet. He told me, just be patient. My case is almost identical to the Snyder case.
Have you said those words like specifically to him and he just says, be patient?
Yes, because in government terms, things go very, very slow.
Right.
And I don't want to poke the bear, quite frankly.
Yeah, so, I don't want to poke the bear either, really, because since he's representing you, but obviously the discussion you needed to have whether that decision is relevant to the counts that are, you know, in particular at issue that you pled to.
Like, Mike, it wouldn't be out of bounds for, even if his lawyer is saying be patient, for Jim to say, please explain to me this in a way to prove that I don't, you know, like that. Why should I be patient? Right. That's a fair question to ask your lawyer.
Yeah, those are always fair questions. And, you know, I don't know how much time has gone by or what the nature of the relationship is. But sure, I mean, those are all fair questions to ask an attorney. Hey, this decision came out, you know, from whatever court it is, how does it impact my case, if at all? And I'm sure he'll get an answer from counsel.
Yeah, Jim, I would maybe be a little more pointed in your questions, I guess you could say. When is your sentencing, by the way?
The date hasn't been sent because I have to give testimony.
Okay, yeah. So that's a typical scenario where someone who, as part of their plea agreement, either provides cooperation or other assistance to the government, they wait until you're done with your cooperation in another case. It might be testifying at trial, it might be providing other cooperation. So you're not going to get sentenced because they want to be able to hang that over your head, of course, and they want to make sure that they're giving you a benefit in exchange for something that you're doing for them. So that's a normal thing. Go
ahead, Jim.
I can't expect the government to voluntarily drop anything.
I don't think they're going to go out of their... Yeah, that's a good question, Mike. They're not going to go out of their way to be like, actually, after the Snyder thing, you're good to go.
Well, probably not. But that might be part of the dialogue about, you know, what impact did that case have? Does it affect his plea? You know, does it affect their view of the case? Does he have a valid motion to withdraw the plea? All those sort of things would go into the dialogue between federal prosecutors and his attorney.
Jim, I know that isn't maybe the answer you all wanted. I think you need to have a follow-up conversation and maybe just be a little more, no, please explain to me why I'm being patient. Maybe your lawyer thinks this doesn't apply at all to you, but I feel like they should explain that at the very least, Jim.
Yeah, I had a brief conversation with him the day of the case because I was naturally happy when I heard it. And he said, yes, it'll have an impact, but give me a little time. And he's very expensive and very good.
Okay, well, that's good. I mean, the expensive part's not good, but the good part's good. So, yeah, maybe have some follow-up conversations with him. Obviously, you don't have a sentencing date yet. You can always reach back out to me during the show, either text if you need a follow-up or you want someone else's phone number for a second opinion or something. I don't want to put Mike Leonard on the spot. Obviously, you have a good lawyer, too, and Mike wouldn't want to say, come to me for sure, like he's not that kind of guy. Right, Mike?
I'm not that kind of guy, John.
Yeah, exactly. So talk to your lawyer some more, Jim. I appreciate you opening up about this. Best of luck with whatever happens, and follow up, okay?
Very well, I will. Thank you both very much, all three of you.
Appreciate the call.
And I didn't have to turn off Patrick's mic now, but wait, now he wants to say something.
Yeah, no, I just have a question for Mike. So how much time does he have?
You mean before he's sentenced?
And file the motion to vacate the guilty plea.
Well, it's a tough call. I mean, if there really was a change in the law, I mean, he hasn't been sentenced. I'm not sure if there was really a time limit for that. And then the weird thing with his situation is, as a cooperator, like it sounds like he's given cooperation in exchange for whatever plea he entered, right? So what can happen is he may be providing cooperation because he may have to testify in someone else's trial.
So a motion to vacate the plea
would
mess up the whole government's case.
He wouldn't have
maybe
that obligation.
On maybe broader things.
Not necessarily. I'm just trying to point out like the procedural time lag in these cases. I mean, if, for example, he has to provide testimony at a trial, and that trial is not for another year or two, which is possible, you wouldn't be sentenced until that trial is done. However, you know, the question of whether the change in the law has an effect on the count he pled to, that's something that would be, you know, addressed sooner than that, and it might give him some leverage, you know. But, you know, it would have no impact upon counts that are irrelevant to that. But if it was a package deal, and, you know, part of the package was a count that has now been reversed, essentially, then, of course, you'd want to address it with the court.
I wonder if it's sentencing, that wouldn't be the appropriate time for a lawyer to make an argument like, and we don't even know if this is still valid. No, that would have to be a motion done separately.
Yeah, you wouldn't wait till the sentencing and say, hey, gee, judge, by the way, count four that I pled to is no longer good law. You would file, you know, you'd use a different vehicle.
Yeah.
And you might not want to get out of your plea agreement because there might be another count that's part of the package that you had to plead to, right? And still the government's position may be, yeah, you pled to X count. He didn't plead to Y count, you know, where it doesn't change our analysis of what we think the appropriate sentence is.
So what's the benefit to waiting, if any? So let's assume all the accounts are relevant to the recent law. Why would you wait? Why not just file that right away?
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're thinking. I mean, obviously, there may be some dialogue behind the scenes between counsel and the federal prosecutors about what impact that's going to have, whether they want to renegotiate the plea. So there would certainly be a discussion first with the government before you filed the motion.
Seems like leverage. You would want to file that motion so you have leverage as to what happens.
But maybe
next.
You don't want
to.
Well, he even said, he's like, maybe we don't want to poke the bear publicly in a way that would counter some trial that's happening in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. It's so much speculation on our part. Okay. But yeah, you'd want to have.
But this is fun
first
to
of all,
speculate wildly.
First of all, have the discussion with the counsel. Get an explanation as to why it does or does not matter to the count you pled to. Figure out whether you have a valid motion to withdraw the plea, whether that's even a good idea in light of the deal that you got and the other counts that are part of the plea package, and take it from there. But yeah, it requires obviously direct communications with the lawyer.
312-981-7200. Well, that was interesting stuff there.
It was.
I like that.
That's why we wanted to keep Dolan muted the whole time.
I know. I just asked a simple question.
No, you're good. 312-981-7200. Do you have an employment law issue? Let's get Patrick Dolan to be able to weigh in on something. Call 312-981-7200. Maybe you were laid off and you think improperly. Maybe something squirrely is happening at work and you think you're being discriminated on based on your gender, perhaps. Maybe your age. Something along those lines. Were you entitled to PTO? PTO when you left your job and you didn't get it, or you're curious about how that works, something with the medical leave. There's a lot of things Patrick Dolan can talk about, too. He is also very smart, we promise, even though he didn't say a word for 9 minutes during that conversation. 312-981-7200. I'm going to call this approach today that we're doing for this hour the Home Sweet Home approach, where Hochberg will have all of his guests kind of talk about everything, whether it's center guard plumbing, you get Janelle Iacchino with the bugs, you get Sarah Leonard with real estate. And so it's a grab bag, and that's what we have here. We have an employment lawyer to my left. We have a federal defense attorney to my right, and we'll help fill in the gaps with any of your legal questions. 312-981-7200. This one's for you, Patrick.
Oh,
from
exciting.
The 708.
Thanks. Okay.
10 weeks into my paid maternity leave on FMLA, I was let go. Do they have to pay me for the final 2 weeks? Do they have a case? I thought they couldn't fire me while I was on FMLA.
Well, maybe they shouldn't, but, you know, couldn't's a different word. First of all, FMLA leave is unpaid. So you get up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave if you need it. She's taken 10, so yes. She has two left. She was terminated after the 10th week. So the issue is, what's the basis for the termination? It certainly looks like it's retaliatory and discriminatory in violation of the FMLA, but we don't know what's happened before she left for maternity leave. For example, maybe she was on a performance improvement plan. Maybe she was going to be terminated and then she filed for FMLA. Maybe there's a layoff where she was rightfully included in the folks who were laid off. So in other words, her leave had nothing to do with it.
So circumstances changed at the company while she was
exactly.
gone, and they wanted to do a layoff.
Okay. Exactly. Now, that's a heightened level of questioning and evidence that I'm going to need, because it does look so bad when somebody's on any kind of protected leave and they're terminated. So I have a lot of questions as to what happened before and what was going on during the time that she was on leave.
But on its face, there's no rule saying you can not fire someone on FMLA.
That's correct. Although most of the time the facts line up that it is retaliatory or discriminatory.
The company basically, it seems like you're saying, has to prove that the FMLA was not at all a part of the firing, and if that person had been continuing in their employment as if nothing had happened, they would have been let go anyways.
Yeah, that's generally the legal standard. That's right.
Okay, we got a caller here. I don't know if you two will be able to answer Kathy's question, but we can certainly dig into it. Kathy, welcome to WGN.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. What's your issue here today?
Okay, I've got a friend who was in the hospital, had surgery, and while she was still in a nursing home for rehab, her husband passed away.
Oh, gosh, I'm sorry.
She was a dependent on his policy, and after she got home, she found out, even though his work said, oh, no, she was covered through August, no problem. They were still paying him out for his PTO time. But eventually she got through to somebody who said that they canceled his insurance the day after he passed away.
That doesn't seem right. Isn't there some sort of COBRA rules, or do you have to still be alive to be able to be offered COBRA? A spouse can't buy COBRA for you or something.
No, she was, when she got home and went through 12 inches of mail, found an offer for COBRA.
Okay.
To cover. But the question is it really, I thought if someone was still getting paychecks, and once you get past the first of the month, the insurance is covered for the month.
Interesting question. That actually, I bet, is something you might be able to weigh in on, or at least look up an answer.
No, I can.
Okay.
So I hate to say it depends, but it really depends what the policy says. Sometimes health insurance will cut off as of the last employment date, your employment end date. Sometimes it's at the end of the month of the month where the person was let go. Okay. So it really, insurance.
Well, he wasn't let go. He wasn't let go.
Right. He passed away. Right.
He was no longer an employee.
Right. Unfortunately. Yeah. So, but also, if he was still getting PTO checks, maybe there was a lingering check that still went in. That doesn't change the employment date or the insurance end date necessarily. It all has to do with the company policy.
Totally. PTO date really has nothing to do with either of those two things. You're supposed to be paid PTO in your last employment date or the next paycheck, but that has nothing to do with that insurance issue.
So a company could say, sorry, your last employed day was, and unfortunately in this case, the last day this person was alive, insurance doesn't automatically go till the end of the month.
Not automatically, no. And it's by the terms of the policy having nothing to do with the employer.
Oh, it has nothing to do with the employer.
No, it's the terms itself. Of the insurance policy.
Oh, man. Kathy, yeah, obviously there's a lot there. And
I'm happy to talk
yes,
with
her. There is.
Yeah, if you want to, Kathy, if your friend wants to call Patrick,
sure,
she can dig into more specifics. His number, and I'll say this a couple times, Kathy, throughout the rest of the show, but it's 312-332-7800. 312-332-7800. Mike Leonard to my right, Patrick Dolan to my left. Mike Leonard is a federal defense attorney. Patrick Dolan is an employment lawyer. I'm a radio host, so the biggest ego-filled room we've ever had here at WGN at the same time.
Well, I think we could both agree that John wins that competition.
Yes,
hands
I
down.
I think that new haircut's making him feel a little sassy.
Yeah, I think he feels yeah. a
feels,
little full of himself
good.
Today.
Yeah, feels
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
Got the Hawks thing coming up.
And I don't blame him with that haircut.
So, Mike Leonard, you're very interested in the AT&T case. It definitely made headlines reading about this 11-1 decision that ultimately, obviously, isn't 12, so there's no unanimity. Nope, that's not the word. Why don't you explain this case?
It's not unanimous.
Yeah, so briefly, I think some people have probably heard about it because it's in the news extensively this week. It was an AT&T executive, Paul LaChiazza. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. The theory of the government in the case in federal court in Chicago was that he was responsible for the fact that AT&T hired what are essentially the equivalent of ghost payrollers. They weren't employees, but they were consultants who were handpicked by Madigan, who wanted, you know, the theory was that Madigan handpicked them, wanted
Mike
them
paid. Madigan, former Speaker of the House in
yeah,
Illinois.
Yeah, that he wanted them paid. They did no work. And the reason AT&T did it was the government's theory was that they wanted legislation passed favorable to them. And as many of you heard, the case resulted in a mistrial, meaning the jury could not come to a unanimous verdict. So if it's not 12-0, if it's 11-1, 7-5, whatever.
How long does a judge allow them to keep going? Because he'll send them back a bunch. They do not want to make this non-unanimous, right?
Yeah, it's not easy to get a mistrial declared because the judge is going to make them do their work and make them do their work again, even when they come back to the court and say, hey, look, judge, we're deadlocked. So
do they say what the vote total is, by the way, or does
the
judge?
No. So the instructions tell the jury, hey, if you're deadlocked and if you need to let me know that, I never want to know when you send me notes what your deliberations are. Don't tell me if you're 6-6, 7-5, 8-4, whatever.
Ooh, interesting.
However, this case was kind of a classic example. The jury deliberated for an extensive period of time. They came back to the judge and said, hey, look, we're deadlocked. And at that point of the trial, I mean, at that point of the deliberations, the judge made the discretionary decision. Hey, look, I don't think, you know, if you've deliberated long enough in his view, right? And so he gave them the charge to go back, you know, re-review the evidence with an open mind and listen to your fellow jurors, all that sort of stuff. And then after a relatively significant period of additional time, they came back and said, hey, judge, we're deadlocked. At that point, he declared a mistrial, meaning that he's neither guilty nor not guilty, and the prosecution has the discretion to retry him, which they most likely will. What Patrick and I were talking about, which we found interesting, is they interviewed one of the jurors, and I heard this interview today. It was like on YouTube or something like that. And what she was saying, you know, because the press was saying, gee, it was 11-1 against him. So, gee, look, you know, it wasn't that strong of a defense. They almost had him. But when you listen to the juror, I think it was kind of insightful.
Was she the holdout?
No, she was not the holdout.
Okay.
But what she said, and it would be nice to have her on the air, but what she said was, hey, you know, over a course of time, a number of people, you know, came to our side, which points out as a defense lawyer, what you always think is happening in there. You know, you feel like people are losing their will, they're breaking down, they're not willing to continue to debate it.
Like, meaning that maybe that it was 6-6 at first.
Oh, yeah.
And eventually they're just like, all right, fine, guilty, fine, whatever.
Yeah, and we don't know the actual mechanics of that jury room, but I think her thoughts were kind of what you always fear as a defense lawyer, that, you know, you have a long deliberation, you start to get excited, you start to get hopeful, because that's typically in our interest on the defense side. It depends on the case. But you start to get very optimistic and hopeful, and you're always counting on or hoping for there's some people that, you know, despite the maybe perhaps the will of the majority to find your client guilty, that there's other people that have a lot of reasonable doubt. But you always have the worry that they're going to be kind of run over by the majority. And I'm not saying that happened in this case, but it's interesting to hear her perspective. which, you know, makes it sound something more different than, oh, it's just 11-1 all along. It clearly was, from what she said, a situation where a number of jurors over time joined the guilty folks.
You know, I had read an article that said that the jury deliberated for, I think it was 17 hours after the judge had said, you know, go back and try again. They went back and tried again. And then the judge decided to declare mistrial after about 17 hours, I think I read.
Total hours, right?
Total hours of deliberation. Yeah. Are judges different in terms of when they sort of pull the plug? Because if they're not being told numbers, they don't know if it's 6-6 or 11-1 at that time. How do judges determine when it's time to declare a mistrial because the jurors say they're dead?
Is it a vibe?
Yeah, completely. Seriously, is that their experience?
No, I think there's, John, you do make a good point. I mean, it's based upon that judge's experience. Mm-hmm. They have complete discretion. Right, you may have defense counsel jumping up and down after the first 14 hours where they're telling the court, hey, judge, we're deadlocked. And you may have defense counsel jumping up and down saying, judge, you need to declare mistrial. You need to declare mistrial.
The judge doesn't just make the decision on his own. Does he hear from the lawyers when this happens?
The parties are always going to be. But predictably, the government's typically saying, judge, they should continue to deliberate. Defense counsel usually says, no, judge, declare mistrial. Unless you have such a strong feeling as a defense lawyer that it's so going to be overwhelmingly in your favor that the holdout is somehow for the government. But that's a risky thought and one I've never really had.
And plus the judge is probably not listening to what you guys say anyways.
Well, they're taking into account, but I mean, you're right in sense, John, that they're going to go with what their gut tells them.
Yeah.
So Patrick makes a nice point is that, you know, each case is very fact specific. You know, how many counts are there? Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, it's very different in a 50 count indictment and the expectation of how long that might take to decide the case. How complex is the case?
Right.
How long did the case take to try? All those factors. And I think there is a certain gut levelness to it. But it would be very rare for any judge, when they're initially told by the jury that the deadlock, to say, okay, it's a mistrial. Almost uniformly, they're going to say, they're going to give them what's called a charge, an Allen charge, to say, look, go back. Continue to deliberate, you know, don't sacrifice your beliefs, but listen to your fellow jurors, all that kind of stuff that they hear in the instructions. And then if the jury comes back to them again, there is a high probability they're going to say mistrial, but there are judges who will say no. You know, they'll tell them to deliberate more.
What's the longest you've ever had to wait for a verdict? How many days?
Probably about 3 days.
That's not too bad. I thought it'd be longer than
that. That's about 17 hours.
I'll tell you, though, three days feels like a long time. When you're sitting around, I remember just sitting there in that building, you know, entire day, you know, just sitting
there. Grab coffee across the street or something.
I know, but superstition, the way I do it is
I
never leave the building.
Yeah. Whoa!
No, I leave the building for food, but
and
I never
at the
leave.
End of
like,
the night, yeah.
A lot of lawyers would just go to their office. They'll be in their office the whole time. I never leave the building. I never leave
you
the hallway.
You sit in the hall? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I also want, I want, let's say that, you know, the cafeteria, for instance, in the federal court's on the second floor.
At Dirksen, yeah.
And if they're deliberating and they're there for lunch, they're there for breakfast, I want them to see me walking around being there as well.
Wait, hold on,
hold on. I want them to be engaged.
You want the jurors to see you?
I do.
Huh. I didn't think that they would even ever have the chance of being anywhere near you. And I'm not accusing you of having anything, but I would never think that the jury on their lunch break would ever be anywhere near either the federal government or the defense attorney.
Every day of the week. So during the trial, the jurors go down to lunch, right? The defense lawyers and their clients always go down to lunch. The government rarely goes down to lunch. But
what?
The defense team is always going to be in the lunchroom. And you want them to see that you're humans, you're normal, you're people. You make sure your client's not doing dumb things like being a knucklehead or laughing or, you know, anything like that. But you want them to see you. You want them to see you with your client.
Eating lunch?
It makes you
look like a human.
Yeah, they're normal people. They're normal people. Take that edge off, like, you know, who is this person? You know, you can have no interactions
this is
whatsoever.
Fascinating.
None.
You can have no interactions whatsoever.
No winking, no looking.
You can have 14 jurors, which is the 12 plus the alternates, in the lunch line. You can have the defense lawyers and the client in that lunch line, another part of the lunch line. They can be in the same cafeteria, you know, 20 feet away from each other. Obviously, there can be no communication or attempted communication. But from my standpoint, I want them to see us. I want them to think that we're normal people living our lives. We're humans. That there's a lot at stake here.
So I just want to be clear. You can't, like, buy them lunch.
That's the John Hansen move. You know, yeah. That's why John's on radio.
Yes.
You know, we don't want to go there.
Or, gee, your hair looks good today. Yeah. Can't do any of that.
No.
Okay.
No.
Just wondering.
I think you're right. I think that's such a... I'm surprised that some of your counterparts, and this is what I think sets you apart, Mike Leonard, and you're a fighter, and you will do anything you can to gain any advantage you can.
Legally,
of course. No, but right. I just mean, like, you don't leave a stone unturned when you're defending
but
someone.
But most defense lawyers, they're going down to the cafeteria.
Okay, okay.
They're with their clients, yeah. And they're
it
not
makes
maybe,
perfect sense.
They're not maybe thinking that, gee, I want the jury to see me with my client being normal, but some do think that, of course. This is not unique to me, but, you know, the defense lawyer and their client, they're down in the lunchroom every single freaking day of that trial.
Well, yeah.
And they might not be caring or thinking about what impact that's going to have on the jury, and sometimes it has none.
Of course.
But I want them, the jury, to have every opportunity to see that my person's a normal human being,
right.
And that I am.
And that you're cordially interacting with them.
Yes.
It makes them seem...
like regular folks.
It's all subtle, right? It's not
it
like
is.
It's not beating them over the head with it, but it could be just this humanizing experience.
And they might not like it. The jury might be like, "Wow, I hate that lawyer, Leonard. And why do I have to see him in a lunchroom every day?" You know,
maybe
you know.
That's why some lawyers maybe aren't there.
You're a charming guy, though.
Oh,
okay,
yeah, of course.
Of course, you want to be there.
Really interesting point that the texter made as you were talking, Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, saying that while jury. The whole trial, whether it's deliberation or whether it's just the day in court, they go to lunch. The jury, I had no idea, would be in the same cafeteria as the defendant. And obviously, if he's not in custody, he or she is not in custody. And the lawyer, Mike, you just say that, look, we want to go in the lunchroom. We cannot talk to him. We can't make any motion. We can't wink. There's nothing that improper that happens, but that it's important for you. You think maybe could make the difference. Maybe just to humanize this person. So the texter said is, could the defendant's kids be in the lunchroom with them? Could they be at the trial? Like, how does that work?
Oh, sure. And you know, just like Patrick and I think we'd both agree, whether you're trying a civil case, whether you're trying a criminal case, you always want some support in the courtroom itself for your client. So, for instance, you know, let's say you're representing the husband or the wife. You'd want the other spouse to be there in the gallery, very front and center, maybe perhaps with their kids or whoever, depending upon the circumstance. And obviously, you have to think about what impression that makes. But, you know, you brought up, John, the Trump trial. Of course, in a very calculated manner, they brought people into that courtroom, family members, high-ranking political people. They wanted the jury to see those people. They wanted the jury to believe that the defendant, in that case Trump, had support. Same thing in any other case, whether it's a civil trial or a criminal trial. You want them to see the jurors that they have support, they have family, they're real people, and you hope that it makes an impression upon them.
Patrick, I think Mike ignored the part where I said don't bring up the Trump trial, but...
No, but it's a good example. I mean,
no, right, exactly. Yeah. You want people there. Absolutely.
I didn't hear that. I wonder if there's ever a backlash. If like, you know, talking to jurors afterwards, saying, you know what, I didn't like the fact that there are all these people sitting behind the defendant, and I thought that was like they're overreaching and trying to impact my decision-making, and I find that kind of offensive.
Absolutely. That's 100% possible. And, you know, you have situations sometimes where you have people come on behalf of your client, and sometimes people are disruptive, not intentionally, but they're coming in and out, or there's too many of them, or they're talking.
Picking on their phone
when they
shouldn't be. And
you have to talk to them like, hey, look, you know, you're here, but you got to be extremely engaged, you know, and you have to make sure that this is a positive. So
right, because it could be a detriment.
Yeah, I agree with you, Patrick, because, you know, a lot of times, especially in federal criminal trials, especially in Chicago, we don't get to interview the jurors.
Yeah.
And sometimes rare instances we do if they want to be talked to, but that usually doesn't happen. And there's a rule that prohibits us contacting them. But I would like to know. Sometimes I'm sure you're right. They probably say, I didn't like that touch. I mm-hmm. saw right through that.
Right.
You know, you had the family member there, or the spouse, or the kids.
Disingenuous.
I didn't like that. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have been there. They shouldn't have been hearing about this.
Yeah.
And they were a prop. And I bet that sometimes there is a backlash.
Yeah, but it's also like, was that the determining factor, though? But you never
know
what is or isn't, right? But it's, again, jurors probably act obviously they act on evidence. They try to as much. Remember, we talked to Jeff, my friend, who did a great job and was a great juror. And I think a lot of people really do go in not trying to make a vibes-based decision.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That stuff undoubtedly infiltrates it. Patrick, who should be reaching out to you, and how should they be reaching out to you?
Anybody with a workplace issue, hiring, termination, investigation, compensation issue, anybody who's being investigated by their own employer for harassment, et cetera. I've had a lot of those lately. Any workplace issue.
And what number should they call you at?
312-332-7800.
And that's where you can reach Karen Conte or Patrick Dolan. She does the family law. He does the employment law. Mike Leonard, you've... really shown your defensive side here today in a good way.
I enjoyed it.
It was really fun to watch you. Yeah, I did too. What number do you want people to reach you at, and who should be reaching out to you?
Sure. Anybody who is accused of, being investigated for, charged with either a federal or a state crime, could be here, could be elsewhere, and also people who are or are thinking about becoming whistleblowers, 312-380-6559. That's it, John. LeonardTrialLawyers.com.
Great stuff. This was a lot of fun, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John. Thanks for letting us talk a little bit this time. Usually, you know, we don't get any words in. Right, Patrick?
No, that's how it goes usually.
Yeah.
You just have to talk. Just keep talking,
You
usually
have to contribute to his charities or his foundations, and then I'll let you talk. So.
Those are all shell companies anyway. So.
Yeah, I did feel him, with the haircut. He was a little different today.
Yeah, it felt good.
This haircut cost $22, by the way.
Okay, 11 each, Mike.
That's 21 too much, Patrick.
All right, guys, that's it. I'm turning off their mics. You can hear the whole conversation if you missed any of it at WGNRadio.com and our great conversation with Vogel Zhang Law as well at WGNRadio.com. Big thanks to Iridian, who also worked double duty all week long. She was producing for Lisa Dent all week long and did a great job at that.